Hey there, sports history fan. Arnie Chapman here from the Sports History Network. Now, before you jump into this episode, I wanted to share with you an exciting giveaway we have going on with Home Field Apparel. We have a digital $50 gift card to homefieldapparel.com for one lucky fan of the Sports History Network. All you got to do is head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways to sign up. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways.
If you know of a product that could help athletes reduce concussions by over 99%, wouldn't you want it? If NFL athletes like defensive back Daniel Sorensen of the Kansas City Chiefs and New Orleans Saints used it, wouldn't you want it? As athletes get bigger, stronger, and faster, we're seeing an increase in the amount of concussions in contact sports. According to the National Football League, concussions increased by 18% in the 2022 regular season. We're also seeing an increase in concussions in other sports. According to the Centers for Disease Control, there are between 1.6 and 3.8 million sports-related brain injuries every year. But there's new technology out there where data has shown to reduce concussions by 99.98%. We at the Football Learning Academy are driven to help athletes improve safety and reduce injuries. We've seen the effects on older players and want to do what we can to make contact sports safer for those who participate. That technology that we're talking about is the Power Plus mouth guard. Unlike other mouth guards, this is worn on the lower part of your jaw. How it works is that it shifts the position of your jaw to an optimally physiologically aligned position to reduce the G-force impact on your brain. If that's not enough, the Power Plus mouth guard has shown to increase an athlete's performance by increasing strength, stamina, and oxygen intake, all while allowing you to speak normally while wearing the device. The Power Plus mouth guard works for every sport and is very easy to customize to each individual in order to position your jaw at its optimal physiological location for your unique bite. Over-the-counter mouth guards are one size fits all. The Power Plus mouth guard is revolutionary, and the data has shown results. Of the over 6,500 athletes that use the Power Plus mouth guard, the amount of diagnosed concussions was 0.2%. If you're an athlete or the parent of an athlete, you'll want to learn more about the Power Plus mouth guard. Go to powerplusmouthguard.com to learn more and tell them that the Football Learning Academy sent you. Welcome to the official Football Learning Academy podcast. I'm your host, Ken Crippen, and I'm the founder and lead instructor at the Football Learning Academy, an online school teaching pro football history. To learn more about the Football Learning Academy, go to our website at www.football-learning-academy.com. Not only will you find links to our social media channels and a listing of all podcast episodes, but you'll find other fascinating interviews and classes. And an important note, a portion of all proceeds generated at the Football Learning Academy go to help retired players in need. That website again is www.football-learning-academy.com. If you like what you hear on this or any of our episodes, give us a 5-star rating and review on the podcast platform. It helps us grow our podcast so that we can continue to bring you quality content. If you're interested in becoming a sponsor for our show, email us at admin@football-learning-academy.com to talk about the various options available to you. We'd love to talk to you about adding you to our team. Now on to our episode. Today's special guest is historian and author Mike Richmond. He has authored 4 books, including his most recent, titled George Allen, A Football Life, which is the subject of this interview. He has also written The Redskins Encyclopedia, The Washington Redskins Football Vault, and Joe Gibbs, An Enduring Legacy. He has also written thousands of feature and news articles for such publications as The Washington Post, The Baltimore Sun, and Sports Illustrated. Now let's get to our interview with historian and author Mike Richmond. I'd like to welcome historian Mike Richmond to the official Football Learning Academy podcast. How are you doing today, Mike?
Doing well, Ken. Thank you very much for having me on your show.
Well, thanks for being here. I appreciate it. You just recently published a book on George Allen. So why was it important to you to write this book?
George Allen coached the Redskins at a time when I was very young, and I just became hooked on that team. I was 10 years old when Allen came to D.C. in 1971, and that was the first true NFL team that I rooted for. I did pull for the Baltimore Colts a little bit because they were great around that time. if you recall, they went to Super Bowl V. They won Super Bowl V. So they were a really good team, Johnny Unitas, a quarterback team. But being a D.C. native, I grew up in Montgomery County, Maryland, D.C. suburb. So that was my team. Came to know Allen, admired him very much as a head coach, and learned a little bit about his eccentricities even at that time. Came to know the players and knew them by name, number, one of whom appeared at my father's men's clothing store in a promotional appearance, running back Charlie Haraway. So I just became so attached to that team. At the same time, I gained a love for history as a kid, and I saw they had talent as a writer as a kid. So then the years go on. I wrote for my high school newspaper, college newspaper. That's the career I chose as a profession, journalism, and embarked on a literary career as well. This is my fourth book, George Allen, A Football Life. So in terms of his, beyond that, in terms of his worthiness for a definitive biography, he's the third all-time leading coach in NFL history for those who have won at least 100 regular season games in winning percentage. He has a 7-12 winning percentage. Madden is first, and then Lombardi, and then Allen. Allen is also a member of the Pro Football Hall of Fame, and never had a losing season in his coaching years in the NFL. That's a phenomenal mark. Then later, two seasons coaching in the USFL, all 14 seasons, never had a losing year. So definitely, he was definitely worthy of a definitive biography.
Now, you had mentioned this is your fourth book. Tell me a little bit about the other three that you've written.
Sure. My first book was The Redskins Encyclopedia. It was published in 2007. It was a look at the team from its inception in 1932. They started as the Boston Braves in 1932, all the way to what was then the present through the 2006 season. So that was 75 years of Redskins history, season by season. I wrote biographies on all of the Redskins who were in the Hall of Fame at the time, including Allen, and also other great Redskins players. So there were a lot of bios in there, a lot of statistics. That was my first book. The Washington Redskins Football Vault was published in 2010. That was a memorabilia heavy book. It was replicas of game programs, press passes, ticket stubs. But I wrote the text for that book. And at the time, from what I understood, there was only one other NFL team that had a book like that, which was the Buffalo Bills. There was several other colleges that had that type of book. 2015, I wrote Joe Gibbs and Enduring Legacy. That was published by his foundation, Youth for Tomorrow. That was a photo-heavy book. I wrote all of the captions for the photos in the Redskins and NASCAR chapters. Someone else who had been aligned with him through Youth for Tomorrow, she did the chapter on Youth for Tomorrow, as well as his spiritual chapter. And then now we have my fourth book, George Allen, A Football Life.
Now, talk to me about George Allen's personality and his coaching style.
He was just he had his quirks, he had his eccentricities. He was just a different type of coach than you would think of his coaching peers. Like, his peers at the time were Don Shula, Chuck Noll, Tom Landry. I mean, they were straight-laced. I mean, you knew basically what you were getting out of them, which really wasn't much of a personality at all. With Allen, I mean, he was just a lot different in the way he handled himself, the way he handled himself with the media. He wanted the media to basically be cheerleaders at the time. He was very guarded in what he shared with the media, which is really, in that sense, he was ahead of his time. But he was also a cheerleader. He wanted them to be a cheerleader. Instead of being critical of his team, he wanted them to be more, you know, root for the Redskins more in D.C. But he had that as a coach. I mean, he was brilliant. He was such a workaholic, and he was so detail-oriented. He knew so much about the opposing teams. As the saying goes, I mean, his plan was to know more about the team, his opposing upcoming opponent, than they actually knew about themselves. Now, that's really impossible, but that was what he tried to attain as a coach. He was one of the first 24/7 workaholic coaches, and he was an innovator as a coach. He established schemes on defense, which are still part of the game today, the 5 and 6 man defensive backs, nickel and dime defenses. He was known as the first coach who really had mini camps. When he was with the Los Angeles Rams starting in 1966, he introduced the first true mini camp that year. He wanted the players to be focused on football in the off season, much more so than his coaching peers. Also, he was really big on free agency. And let me explain. In 1976, there was an unfettered year of free agency in the NFL. I mean, there was a situation where the players and owners, I mean, they couldn't come to some type of agreement. So they just said, you know, we're just going to open it up, let anybody sign a free agent that they want to, and any of the teams. Allen took full advantage of that. He signed free agents much more so than any of the other coaches or GMs in the team. By the way, he was both the coach and the general manager for the Washington Redskins. He signed John Riggins, Gene Fugit, Calvin Hill, and Pat Sullivan, who actually never ended up playing for him. But he really took advantage of free agency much more so than other coaches. And that was actually a precursor to the way a lot of what we see today, a lot of the emphasis on free agency and building your teams that way. Now, there's one other thing that needs to be taken into consideration. Allen really didn't have much of a draft to work with. I mean, he had traded so many draft picks away. He didn't trust rookie players. He trusted veteran players a lot more, which is the direction he wanted to go in with the Rams. And then he took it to a much higher level with the Redskins. He just dealt so many draft picks away like a deck of cards. So he really didn't have too many draft picks to work with at the time. And early on when he came to DC, you know, the reporters were saying, hey, you know, the more draft picks you trade away, you're going to mortgage the future, which really kind of did come true toward the end. I mean, he never had a losing season in DC, but toward the end, 9-5 in 1977, they were good, but they were not a great team like similar teams in that era, such as the Steelers and the Cowboys, Los Angeles Rams, for that matter, Minnesota Vikings. The Redskins were not at that level at the time. They were a good team. But Allen, what he did is he tried to take advantage of a free agency much more so than any other coach or general manager did that year.
You mentioned the Rams, so let's start talking about his pro career. In 1957, he was hired as the offensive ends coach for the Rams under Sid Gilman. Talk to me about that experience for him, even though it was only a single season.
Right. Well, on paper, it was kind of a strange hiring. I mean, Allen was a defensive specialist. And even in college, he was coming off his college coaching career. He had coached 3 years in Morningside and 3 years at Whittier College in Los Angeles. I'm sorry, 3 years at Morningside and six at Whittier, 9 years total. So he was coming off that experience. In college, he was known, he had already earned the reputation as a defensive-oriented coach. It was an offense was kind of like 3 yards in a cloud of dust with him. So it was interesting that he was hired as the offensive ends coach. So in my research for the book, I caught up with Sid Gilman's daughter, and I asked her, well, why would your father hire him as the offensive ends coach if he was so focused on defense? And she said, because he wanted his expertise and his knowledge for understanding from an offensive perspective, defenses on the other side, you know, how they would line up, whatever. So, you know, schemes, positioning, he wanted that, you know, Sid Gilman wanted that type of knowledge as part of his coaching staff. So, but unfortunately, Allen was let go after one season. The most definitive thing that I could find in the newspapers that I researched is that he was let go after the season. Nothing really was worded like that, but you really had to come to that conclusion because he was only one of two coaches who left that coaching staff after the season. And he didn't have a job lined up either. He was without a coaching job for, you know, 6 to 8 months until the Bears took him in early in the 59 season.
Well, let's talk about that role with the Bears. What did he do and what was his impact with the Bears?
He was first hired as the head talent scout for the Bears early in the 59 offseason. That's what why Halas first brought him in. One of the Bear staff members, he passed away. So the position was open. Actually, what happened is when Allen was out of coaching, he was selling weighted footballs. And so he made his way into the Bears training camp. And that's how he met Halas. Or he became further acquainted with him. I think they had met at a Allen was very, very, he was daring. He was bold in the sense he made his way into an NFL coaches session of some type. He actually made his way into Sid Gilman's summer training camps as well. That's how he came to know Gilman. But so he came to know Halas beforehand. Anyway, he became further acquainted with him when he got into the Bears training camp. Halas brought him in as a spy because Halas knew that he had coached with the Los Angeles Rams. Halas brought him in as a spy for two late season Bears games in 58, because the Bears had two games against the LA Rams. And then Halas hired him as the head talent scout in 59. He held that role through the end of the 62 season. He actually took over on an interim basis for Clark Shaughnessy as the defensive coordinator late in the 62 season. Then he was fully hired as the defensive coordinator early in the 63 offseason, and then he became the architect of that great Bears defense in 63, which paved the way to that the Bears winning the championship that year.
Now, in 66, he went back to the Rams, but this time as head coach. But then that started a legal battle with Halas. What can you tell me about that legal battle?
Sure. So after the 63 championship win, I mean, Allen was a hot name on the coaching market. I mean, there are other teams. Why wouldn't you want to be interested in him? I mean, he was the person who wanted to be hired by opposing teams. And so here we come to the 65 season. Allen is still on the staff of the Chicago Bears. The Rams job opens up. Dan Reeves, Rams owner, offered the job to Allen. Allen accepted. Well, Halas didn't like that. There was some proprietary information that was written in Allen's Bears contract. And I actually saw this in the Allen archives that I researched at the Pro Football Hall of Fame. And it said, you know, you have this special knowledge of the Bears organization. So Halas cited that in a court case. He challenged him, took it to civil court in the Chicago area, Cook County Civil Court. Circuit Court. The judge actually ruled for Halas in the case. And so based on that, Allen had to stay with the Bears. Halas, though, he stood up at the end of the trial session. He says, listen, Your Honor, George Allen is free to go to whatever team he wants to go to. I think what Halas had won the case based on principle. He wanted to prove something. You know, he won, you know, he got what he wanted. He let Allen go to become the head coach of the Los Angeles Rams.
Now, during this time, Allen was the first one to hire a special teams coach. Who was that well-known coach that he hired to coach special teams?
He hired Dick Vermeil in 1969. Vermeil was previously with Stanford University. So Allen hired him as special teams coach. That was another area of the game that Allen was a tremendous innovator, not only defense, but special teams as well. He was far beyond his coaching peers in terms of his emphasis on special teams. Practice, he put a lot of time into the game, into that aspect of the game. In 1967, just to give you an example of the focus that Allen had on special teams, Tony Guillory, a backup Rams linebacker, but the special teams captain, he blocked a punt late in a game against the Green Bay Packers late in that 67 season. The Rams were trailing 24-20 at the time. There was like a minute and a half left. Blocks a punt. Rams recovered, run it down to the 5-yard line. Roman Gabriel throws the winning touchdown pass to Bernie Casey. Great win for the Rams. Allen's carried off the field after the game. The following week, they beat the mighty Baltimore Colts in the season-ending game, and that got the Rams into the playoffs that year, where they lost to the Packers in the opening round. Just to tell you about that Colts team, just like the Rams that year, finished 11-1-2 and did not go to the playoffs. Now, that would be unimaginable today. I mean, just think, an 11-1-2 team not going to the playoffs, or that was a 14-game season back then. I mean, you have teams with losing records that are winning divisions today, seven teams per conference going into the playoffs. That didn't exist then. But so just to give you like a snapshot of the competitiveness of the NFL at the time. So back to your point about Dick Vermeil, Allen hired him as a special teams coach in 1969. And also the same year, the Eagles hired Marv Levy as their true special teams coach as well. So those two were the first special teams coaches, Vermeil and Levy, in 1969.
Now, 1970, Allen's released from the Rams again. What happened there?
Allen had been fired actually one time prior to that in another surreal event in his life. We spoke about the court case with Hallis. This was another surreal event. After the firing following the 1968 season, Allen called for a press conference. He wanted to somehow get, you know, make his point that he wanted his job back. And what he did is he told the players about it. He told his Rams players. About 20 of them, veteran Rams players, showed up at the press conference. Roman Gabriel, Deacon Jones, Ed Metter, who else? Merlin Olsen, he was there. His veteran players. And they basically said, listen, Dan Reeves, if you don't rehire George Allen, we're quitting. So, and they were coming off a great season too. They didn't make the playoffs in 68, but they finished 10-3-1. It's another example of a great team not making the playoffs. Finished 10-3-1. So Allen had them on a roll. The players did not want to lose him as the head coach. They said, you need to rehire him, Reeves, or we're quitting. And Reeves would have been left with like a, you know, totally youthful team, all rookie team or whatever. So Reeves rehired him about 3 weeks later. Now, Reeves was quoted as saying, it's in my book, that he didn't rehire him because of what the player said. You know, he just felt actually the team doctor, actually, who Allen was very close with, he set up a meeting between Allen and Reeves. And Allen got, you know, he had a little bit to drink. He really didn't drink that much. So he was laughing a lot. Reeves, who was actually a big drinker, it was a jovial atmosphere. And then shortly after that, Reeves rehired him as the head coach in January of 69. So then Reeves fired him again after the 70 season. This time there was no situation of a rehiring. By the way, after the 68 firing, the Redskins were already after George Allen. Edward Bennett Williams, the Redskins' minority partner, he wanted Allen. The two had actually met at a NFL meeting in Hawaii after the 66 season. Allen also knew Jack Kent Cook, who was the he had the majority percentage of the team at the time. So, and both Cook and Williams wanted Allen after the 68 season. So then after the 70 firing, that's when they lured him to D.C., following a second firing by the Rams. This time they didn't miss on Allen. They got him to coach the Redskins in January of 71.
Did he have full control of the team when he got to Washington?
Yeah, absolute control of everything. They hired him, coach, general manager. He had control of the draft, a trade, player contracts, you name it. He had control of everything. They gave him, you know, full authority to do what he wanted. And one of the first things he did is he built Redskins Park, which was a state-of-the-art facility at the time. He located it in Chantilly, Virginia, which was really a remote area at the time, very close to Dulles Airport. He wanted them away from the city, you know, quiet, focused on football. That was George Allen. He, you know, just thinking about football the whole time, you know, details. And the players really bought into it. They loved Redskins Park. They loved the facility. But that was him. So, but actually that was what led to Edward Bennett Williams' famous remark at the Redskins' welcome home luncheon prior to the 71 season. I gave him an unlimited budget and he exceeded it. That was what Redskin Park, which cost $500,000 at the time, that was a lot of money. And Williams, you know, he was referring to Allen's big spending ways with Redskin Park. And also the big salaries were starting with Allen hiring the veteran players coming in, Ron McDowell, and he hired the Ramskins, paying them a lot of money, Jack Pardee and Dyron Talbert. a lot of those guys who he coached with the Los Angeles Rams. So he got Pettibone too, who he coached with the Chicago Bears and then later coached him with the Rams too. I mentioned McDowell. He got the Verlon Biggs from the Jets. Really, really great defensive lineman.
So after the 77 season, he's let go by Washington, goes back to the Rams, but that time is extremely short. Tell me about that.
Sure. Well, one thing that I explained in the book, and this has been like a common narrative about Allen in D.C., he was not fired after the 77 season. Williams actually offered him a contract extension before the 77 season started. Allen never signed it. The extension did not include the same general manager duties, which he had had before that I explained. It didn't have that. Also, there was no ability for Allen to buy into the team, a stock option clause, which actually did exist in 1971. Allen never took advantage of it. It was not in the contract, but Jack Kent Cook had written to Allen separately in a letter saying that 5% stock option is there if you want to buy into it. Allen never did, but following the 77 season, you can imagine the Redskins were a much more lucrative franchise. The big television contracts were starting at the time with the network. So the Redskins were a much more lucrative franchise. Allen wanted to take advantage of it. That wasn't part of the contract. So at the same time, he and his wife, Etty, still owned their home in the Los Angeles area. So Allen went back to L.A. The Rams job was open. Chuck Knox left the Rams after the 77 season. Carol Rosenblum, the Rams owner, was just fed up with him. Even though the Rams were a really, really good team, they were making, you know, either the NFC playoffs or the NFC championship game. They weren't getting to the Super Bowl. So Rosenblum was really fed up with Knox. And so Knox left. He walked after the 77 season, took the Buffalo Bills job. Allen, the door was open. Allen took the Rams job. But even in the opening press conference, when Rosenblum introduced Allen in January of 78, you can tell that Rosenblum had him on a short leash. Rosenblum was making comments like, and I think he insinuated that he was kind of joking, but he said something like, well, if George Allen doesn't make the Super Bowl, then we're going to have to reconsider his contract or something like that. So you could tell he had him on a short leash. So fast forward to training camp, exhibition season. Allen was let go after two exhibition games. There were things going on in training camp, like Allen had this no water policy, which the doctors actually warned him about. They said, George, you know, you can't do that. This was in the really warm Southern California temperatures, summer temperatures. You can imagine how the doctors were feeling about that. It was pretty scary. But you know very well, he wasn't the only coach to actually do that. There were other coaches in the league who actually did that over the years. So he had that. He had this no trash policy on the field. The players, according, like Fred Dreyer was one of the Rams defensive end at the time. He told me the players didn't really appreciate that. It was kind of like micromanaging. They didn't like that about Allen. Actually, Dreyer told me in an interview, he wanted Don Coryell, his college coach from San Diego State. Because the Rams had a great defense. So the defense was already there, which was actually another odd aspect to the Allen hiring. I mean, he was a defensive-oriented coach. But Rosenblum wanted him because he had this formula for beating the Dallas Cowboys. While he didn't really – he had trouble beating the Minnesota Vikings, he knew how to beat Landry and the Dallas Cowboys, who the Rams were losing to in the playoffs. They were also losing to the Vikings. But so that's actually the reason Rosenblum wanted him. So, but Dreyer wanted Coryell. He wanted Coryell for his offensive, you know, air Coryell. He thought the Rams would score 50 points a game. So Rosenblum, he hired Allen. So, yeah, fired him after two exhibition games. One thing that happened, which according to Dreyer, this took place. Now, Doug Krikorian, he was a reporter for a Southern California newspaper at the time. He was Daily Beat reporter for the Rams. He denied this. But Dreyer told me that Allen traded Isaiah Robertson to the Green Bay Packers. Now, Allen did not have the authority to do that. Isaiah Robertson, the Rams linebacker, who Robertson disliked Allen, did not want him hired as a coach. Allen, I guess, in turn, disliked him and wanted him out. He wanted to, change things up regarding the linebackers. So he somehow was in contact with the Packers. He tried to exercise his trade to the Packers of Robertson. Well, when Dreyer heard about it, actually Jack Youngblood and Dreyer, Allen told him about it after a practice. And both of those guys were like, "Coach, do you have the authority to do this?" And both those guys were like taken aback by the whole thing. So apparently word got to Rosenblum and the coaching staff about that. They didn't really appreciate that. Now, Doug Krikorian actually denied that that story ever took place. He said, quote, "Maybe I have dementia, but I don't remember. I cranked out 7 stories a week on that team. I don't remember that happening, but whatever." I mean, I did that that compare and contrast in the book. But these things were building up. There was like a rebellion on the part of the players. So Allen was let go after 2 exhibition games. He later admitted, and he's quoted in the book as saying this, that he left a really great job in Washington. He really regretted not taking advantage of that contract extension opportunity that he had with that Williams had offered him prior to the 77 season.
One thing I was wondering if you could enlighten me on, it was noted in the early 80s that Allen had tried to get a coaching job with the Bears, but was rejected by George Halas. Is that true?
That is true. He wrote a letter to Halas after the 81 season. I guess Neil Anderson. Neil Anderson was a Bears coach who was fired. I think Allen, if I'm correct, I do have a write-up on this. Allen contacted him during the season in anticipation of something happened. And then he also wrote a letter to him after the season. But Halas, being Halas, he held such a grudge against Allen for what happened in the mid-60s with Allen leaving, taking the head coaching job with the Rams. I think Halas was, when that whole circumstance took place, he was just acting like a petulant child. I mean, you have to let an assistant coach go if he has a head coaching opportunity with another team. Halas felt slighted. Allen actually wanted the head coaching job of the Bears. Halas never hired him as the head coaching job, never as the head coach. He later hired Abe Gibron, I believe, who was just he was a horrible coach. So fast forward to 81. Halas would not hire Allen for that head coaching position. That's when he hired Mike Ditka.
What's the legacy that George Allen leaves behind when it comes to pro football?
First, being an innovator, defense, special teams, all the other things that he was really a step ahead of his coaching peers. That, like I mentioned, the mini camps, free agency, instant replay. He was really, really big on as well. In fact, in the 75 season, there were several calls he felt went against the team. I don't know if you recall a 1975 game the Redskins had against the St. Louis Cardinals in St. Louis. Mel Gray, he was the intended target of a Jim Hart pass with seconds remaining in that game. Gray, the ball hit him in the chest. Pat Fisher was there almost simultaneously, knocked the ball out. Gray's feet never hit the ground. The officials initially ruled it an incompletion. Then after conferring, they ruled it a touchdown. Cardinals tie the game at the end of regulation. They wanted it overtime. With instant replay today, that would not have been a touchdown. The Redskins would have won that game, likely would have gone to the playoffs that year, which they ended up not doing. There was one other call in a game the Redskins had against the Oakland Raiders that game that went against them. So Allen was a big proponent of instant replay as well. So that those things taken into consideration, that's a big part of his legacy. Was inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame in 2002. Like I mentioned, third all-time in winning percentage among coaches with at least 100 regular season career victories. Never had a losing season in the NFL, 12 years coaching in the NFL. In 21 of his 24 years, all told, in professional coaching, including his time with the Rams and previously with the Rams as assistant and with the Bears as an assistant and head talent scout, had only 2 losing seasons. It was part of only 2 losing seasons, 1960 and 1964 with the Bears. So, I mean, the guy was just addicted to winning. An amazing legacy. And I'm glad that he finally got his due with his induction into the Hall of Fame in 2002. And I'm glad that I was able to write the definitive biography on George Allen.
All those accolades, why did it take so long to get into the Hall of Fame?
As explained to me by Len Shapiro, who was, he was actually a beat reporter for the Washington Post covering the Redskins in the 70s. Later, he was on the selection committee for the Hall of Fame, the regular selection committee. And then he was later on the seniors selection committee. He explained to me that the initial resistance was because of Allen's postseason record. He only had a 2-7 postseason record. He lost his only Super Bowl appearance, Super Bowl VII, to the Miami Dolphins. He got knocked down out of the playoffs three times in the first round. So he had a just a pathetic postseason record. So Shapiro explained to me that that was the reason the regular selection committee would not select him for induction into the Hall of Fame. But then when he got to the seniors, that's when Shapiro made a huge push, another huge push for his induction. Shapiro was actually the person who was most lobbying for Allen's induction. Shapiro made a big push again. And also at the same time, this was around, was the early 2000s, a NFL Films produced a documentary on Allen called The George Allen Story, Winning is Living, Losing is Dying. So which told the story of George Allen and, you know, how everything that I just said, you know, how he was addicted to the game, that football was his life, and all the things that he introduced in the game. You had reporters, David Israel from the formerly of the Washington Star, Shapiro, Krikorian was part of that. You had Allen's family talking in that documentary. So the concurrence of the documentary plus Shapiro lobbying for Allen's induction into the Hall of Fame, he got this. Got the nod in 2001. I guess it, back then, maybe it was early 2002, like today, and then he was inducted in the summer of 2002. But to answer your question, the initial reason, from what I understand, was because of his poor playoff record.
Okay. Let's have a little fun here. Can you relay the story about George Allen almost playing a game of checkers with Albert Einstein?
Oh, sure. I would love to do that. That is a very big anecdote in the book. But Allen was in the Navy V-12 program in college. He had been to several schools as part of the V-12 program. The program was to train naval officers who would eventually go into combat during World War II. So, but at the same time, give them a college education. So Allen was first at Alma College in Wisconsin. Then he was at Marquette. Then he ended up at Princeton University. So Albert Einstein was an adjunct professor at Princeton at the time. It's a major coincidence. And Allen was a great checkers player. And he thought, hey, you know, I want to challenge Albert Einstein to a game of checkers. So he said, you know, what better person for me to beat than Einstein? You know, a gene, even this was prior to the atomic bomb, but Einstein was still known as a genius then. So Allen was thinking, what better person for me to beat in checkers than Albert Einstein? So one Sunday morning after church, Allen and a friend of his, they got on the bus, they took it over to Einstein's house near the Princeton campus. So Einstein's assistant answers the door in a deep German accent. She says, Professor Einstein will be down to see you soon. So Allen and his friend walk in. Einstein comes flying down the stairs, you know, hair flying everywhere. And this is very uncharacteristic of George Allen. So Einstein says to him, oh, sure, I'll play you in a game of checkers. Did you bring a board? Allen says, darn, I forgot to bring a board. And that was so antithetical of George Allen. I mean, he was so preparation oriented throughout his life. So they didn't play a game of checkers, but they would have if Allen had brought a board. But Einstein also said he was not a checkers player. He said, people say all kinds of things about me, but I don't play checkers. Actually, one other interesting part of that story is that when Allen and his friend were leaving Einstein's house, as Allen told it, Einstein made this movement with his arms. He spread his arms. He went boom. And Allen didn't know exactly what he was talking about at the time, but in later years figured out he was talking about the atomic bomb. While Einstein was not a part of the Manhattan Project, he was consulted on the creation of the bomb. I guess his theory of relativity was part of the creation of the atomic bomb, which was actually used several months later. But so that's the answer to your question about how Allen nearly played Albert Einstein in a game of checkers.
How can people purchase a copy of the book and learn more about what you're doing?
Sure. Well, if you want an author autographed copy, go to my website, MikeRichmondJournalist.com. It's also available on Amazon. But if you want that, John Hancock, MikeRichmondJournalist.com. Be happy to personalize it for you. But, those are the two major ways you can obtain George Allen A Football Life.
All right. Sounds great. Mike, thank you for being here. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much for having me on, Ken. Certainly appreciate the invitation.
I hope that you enjoyed our interview with historian and author Mike Richmond. Thank you for listening to the official Football Learning Academy podcast. To learn more about the Football Learning Academy, go to our website at www.football-learning-academy.com. Not only will you find links to our social media channels and a listing of all podcast episodes, but you'll find other fascinating interviews and classes. And an important note, a portion of all proceeds generated at the Football Learning Academy go to help retired players in need. That website again is www.football-learning-academy.com. If you like what you've heard with this or any of our episodes, give us a 5-star rating and review on the podcast platform. It helps us grow our podcast so that we can continue to bring you quality content. If you're interested in becoming a sponsor for our show, email us at admin@football-learning-academy.com to talk about the various options available to you. We'd love to talk to you about adding you to our team. Thank you for listening.
Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, aka the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
This is Mark Mortier, and if you're a sports history fan like me, tune in and hear me talk about some great sports moments of the past. Growing up during the 1970s, I got to watch some of the most iconic moments in sports history. Hank Aaron breaking Babe Ruth's home run record. Willis Reed limping out of the locker room in Game 7 of the NBA Finals at Madison Square Garden as the fans erupted with a thunderous ovation. The 1980 Miracle on Ice, as Team USA defeated the powerful Soviet Union in the Olympics. Listen every Tuesday on Yesterday Sports.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcast. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcast. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.